Today is Monday, January 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. U.S., NATO, and Russian officials meet this week to discuss Russia's military buildup along Ukraine.
NATO has a dual-track approach to Russia. We need to now engage in dialogue. We will do so in good faith.
Plus, a tennis star wins his court battle in Australia.
The main thing that the court was concerned about was the unfairness, the manifest unfairness to Mr. Djokovic.
And although South Africa has the highest COVID numbers in Africa, few people there are vaccinated. We'll have these stories and more next. Russian and U.S. officials are meeting today to talk about rising tensions over Russia's military buildup along Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says he welcomes the talks taking place today in Geneva and later this week between Russia and NATO, but doesn't believe the meetings will solve all issues. In addition, Russian diplomats will meet with representatives of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
NATO has a dual-track approach to Russia. We need to now engage in dialogue. We will do so in good faith, and we will sit down around Russia on Wednesday, and we also welcome the fact that the United States are engaged in bilateral with Russia. And then we will do whatever we can, make every effort to ensure a political way forward, preventing the use of force, also preventing Russia from using military force against Ukraine.
Aid agencies have halted operations in a northwest area of Ethiopia's Tigray region near the border with Eritrea after an airstrike there late Friday killed scores of civilians displaced by the conflict. Gelmo DeWitt reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said Sunday that aid groups have suspended their operations in northwest Tigray. Humanitarian partners suspended activities in the area due to the ongoing threats of drone strikes, said the statement to the media. Reuters news agency quoted aid workers saying an airstrike late Friday on a camp near the Eritrean border killed 56 people and wounded 30 others. The UN humanitarian office told the AFP news agency that the attack in the town of Debitas caused scores of civilian casualties. The Tigray People's Liberation Front, the party that has ruled Tigray for decades, condemned the attack. In a statement Saturday, the TPLF accused the Ethiopian government of targeting civilians. It also accused Eritrean forces of attacking Tigrayan fighters in the northwest Tigray on the same day the IDP camp was hit. Ethiopia's federal authorities did not immediately comment on the accusations or the UN announcement on the aid group's withdrawal. But since the outbreak of the war with the Tigrayan rebels in November 2020, authorities have denied targeting civilians. The UN has been warning of worsening humanitarian situation in Tigray. The UN Humanitarian Office said last week that humanitarian agencies operating in Tigray have only one-sixth the amount of fuel needed to distribute limited food aid. It said they continue to face security, bureaucratic and operational challenges, with aid partners forced to reduce or suspend operations, leaving millions of people without access to life-saving assistance. Gelmo DeWitt for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Despite having the highest number of COVID infections in Africa, nearly 2 years into the pandemic, fewer than half of South African adults have been vaccinated. South Africa's government has been reluctant to order vaccine mandates, but private companies are stepping in to encourage people to get the jab. Linda Givtash reports from Johannesburg.
Thousands of COVID-19 vaccination sites have opened across South Africa, but the flow of patients is stalled. From the peak of over 1 million vaccines administered in 1 week in August, numbers have plummeted to under 150,000 last week. The decline comes as the country fell far short of the government target to inoculate 67% of the population by the end of 2021. Florence Mosiani is the operation manager of the Parkhurst Clinic in Johannesburg. She says dispelling misinformation could encourage more people to get their shot.
Providing more health education to our community. Or why vaccinate, what is the importance of vaccinations. Education, giving more information will assist, will reduce those kinds of resistance and myths about the vaccine.
Companies are taking steps beyond public education. Discovery is the largest private health insurer in South Africa. The company encouraged vaccination of its clients by offering rewards points and cash back on life insurance premiums. In September, Discovery also mandated that its 11,000 employees be vaccinated, and the policy worked. Staff vaccination rates jumped from 22% to 94% within 3 months. Dr. Ronald Whelan is the chief commercial officer at Discovery Health and heads the company's COVID-19 task team.
Discovery is well-versed and has done extensive work over the years around the behavioral psychology and incentives and rewards for getting people to behave in particular ways and supporting those behavioral changes. But those behavioral changes only get you to a certain point. Once you start getting to the 70% thresholds, you need firmer levers to get people over the finish line.
Whelan said employees overwhelmingly welcome the mandate and the reassurance it brings for going back to work. But he said 2-3% of employees have remained resistant. As more companies introduce similar policies, legal battles have been raised, arguing it infringes on individual rights. The country is still waiting to see how the courts will rule on the issue. Safura Abdul-Karim is a public health lawyer in South Africa.
We know from previous cases during the pandemic that these competing community rights to life and health weigh extremely heavily and can warrant the infringement of individual rights in certain situations, but particularly in the context of a pandemic as serious as COVID-19. So it is very likely that vaccine mandates will be found to be constitutional in South Africa.
Without faster uptake, the country's hard-won vaccine supply will expire. In November, the government asked Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, as well as the U.S. government, to delay sending more vials. The same month, President Cyril Ramaphosa warned widespread mandates were being considered. Abdul-Karim says the government should have already brought in stronger mandates.
We've reached a point where our supply of vaccines outstrips the demand for them. So we need to get that demand back up so that we ensure that all the vaccines we have at our disposal are utilized and that we reach that goal of population-level immunity.
She says mandates can play a strong role in increasing vaccination rates if other barriers like transportation to clinics and time off work are tackled as well. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Schools are closed again Monday in Chicago because of the teachers' standoff with the city over COVID-19. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has this report.
This is the fourth day Chicago public schools are closed after the winter break, despite negotiations with the teachers' union over COVID safety protocols and remote learning. Disputed issues include testing and metrics to be employed on when to close schools. Most teachers are refusing to come in unless there's an agreement or the current spike in cases brought on by the Omicron variant subsides. Chicago public school leaders are rejecting the teachers' calls for remote learning. They say it's detrimental to the children and that the schools are safe. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Tennis star Novak Djokovic won his court battle to remain in Australia to play in a tournament despite being unvaccinated against COVID-19. Phil Mercer has that story from Sydney.
Novak Djokovic's fans celebrated Monday outside an immigration hotel in Melbourne where he'd been detained. Federal Court Judge Anthony Kelly said the Australian government's decision to cancel his visa was unreasonable. He said that the Serbian tennis star wasn't given enough time to speak with tournament organisers or his legal advisers after he was detained Wednesday at Melbourne Airport, a standard treatment for an unlawful non-citizen, according to Australian law. He'd flown to Australia believing he had an exemption from the country's COVID-19 vaccination regulations, which state all foreign nationals entering the country must be fully inoculated or have a medical waiver. Djokovic said he'd contracted coronavirus in December, which gave him the right to apply for an exemption. However, Australian border authorities had said that the tennis star had not met immigration regulations and would be deported. But his lawyers told the court that the decision to revoke his visa was illogical, irrational, and legally unreasonable. Immigration lawyer John Finlay told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that it was a hard case for the government to win.
This is the outcome I expected, yes. Mr. Djokovic's lawyers put a very compelling case. The main thing that the court was concerned about was the unfairness, the manifest unfairness to Mr. Djokovic about the way
the officers at Melbourne Airport conducted themselves.
Djokovic has been released from detention and will likely be allowed to defend his Australian Open title. He's won the event 9 times. Should he triumph at this year's tournament, he'll become the most successful men's Grand Slam champion with 21 titles. However, Australian Immigration Minister Alex Hawke has the ability to intervene again and order his deportation. Under Australian law, the minister has exceptional authority and discretion to cancel a visa. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Myanmar's ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been sentenced to 4 more years in prison. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
A legal official says the court sentenced Suu Kyi after finding her guilty of illegally importing and possessing walkie-talkies and violating coronavirus restrictions. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate was convicted last month on 2 other charges and given a 4-year sentence then, which was then halved by the head of the military installed government. The cases are among a dozen brought against Suu Kyi since the army seized power last February, ousting her elected government. Suu Kyi's supporters say the charges against her are contrived to legitimize the military's actions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
19 people were killed, including 9 children, and dozens of others were injured when a fire spread smoke through a 19-floor building in the Bronx borough of New York City on Sunday. Fire investigators say they think a malfunctioning space heater caused the deadly blaze. At a news conference, New York City Fire Commissioner Daniel Nigro says the blaze is among the city's worst.
32 people were transported to hospitals in life-threatening condition. That is unprecedented in our city. The last time we had a loss of life that may be this horrific was at Happy Land Fire, which was over 30 years ago, also here in the Bronx.
Thick black smoke filled the building's hallways, causing many residents to trip and fall as they tried to escape. Authorities in Kazakhstan say police detained nearly 8,000 people during protests that descended into violence last week in the worst unrest the former Soviet country has witnessed since gaining independence 30 years ago. Kazakhstan's Interior Ministry reported Monday that 7,939 people have been detained nationwide. Russian tourist Anton Zalevnov's vacation to Kazakhstan took a turn when he found himself caught up in the violent protests. Reuters reporter Luisa Knox has more.
Russian national Anton Zelenov's vacation to Kazakhstan was anything but relaxing.
We had already started taxiing. At some point, we stopped. The aircraft captain announced that we could not download location equipment or weight indicators, so we had to wait for a little bit. After another 10 minutes, he says, "Sorry, the airport has been seized by protesters. Nobody will take off today."
Back in Moscow, he recalled how he found himself caught up in a wave of protests that sparked the deadliest outbreak of violence in the country's 30 years of independence. What started as demonstrations against fuel prices escalated into wider protests against the government, leading to rioting on the streets. Dozens have been killed, thousands detained, and public buildings torched after President Kasym Jomart Tokayev issued shoot-to-kill orders to end the unrest. Zelenov was in Almaty when the protests began.
On the 2nd and the 3rd, we walked around the city. Everything was quiet. Only the central square, the Independence Monument, was closed. The police didn't let anyone in. We tried to take the back streets to go sightseeing. We reached the square. The police didn't let us into the square, but allowed us to take pictures. But there were no protesters. There was nothing there.
Zelenov said things took a turn on January the 5th when he heard stun grenades in the city. He decided to head to the airport to escape the rising violence. After the captain announced its seizure, Zelenov said he spent around 12 hours on the plane before passengers were taken to a shuttle bus bound for the border with Kyrgyzstan. He described what he saw.
Private houses were okay, but the highways looked like something had happened there. And at some point, we passed a vandalized barricade made from burnt cars. We bypassed it. But there were no protesters. No one was controlling it.
Его просто объезжали, но при этом никаких там митингующих не было, никто его не контролировал.
Kazakhstan authorities said on Sunday they had stabilized the situation across the country and troops from a Russian-led military alliance were guarding strategic facilities.
That was Reuters reporter Louisa Knox. U.S. Democrats are mounting an impassioned bid to overhaul Senate rules that stand in the way of their sweeping voting legislation. They say dramatic action is needed to counteract forces unleashed by former President Donald Trump's falsehoods about the 2020 election. On the one-year anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, President Joe Biden and top congressional Democrats want to jumpstart a wide-ranging voting, ethics, and elections package. Jack Rice, a criminal defense lawyer, former prosecutor and former CIA officer who has just returned from Istanbul, says the attack changed Americans forever. He tells me Americans used to believe in the system, but no more.
And when that happens, what it creates is this extraordinary instability. But what makes it weirder is that on the criminal defense side, when I'm sort of this guy who's fighting on the inside of the system and looking up at the system sort of kind of crumbling from above, what it does is something else. It creates this really weird sort of feeling that it's all very pointless and that no matter what happens here, people start to opt out on a regular basis. And I think what this almost is an introduction for the United States to what it feels like to systems that are a lot more unstable than we ever thought ours were.
It sounds like you're saying we knew that democracy was at risk in a lot of these other countries where they were democracy, the idea, the notion, it was just kind of a developing governmental idea. But here in the United States, it seems also that you're saying it's under threat because of the politics in this country has become so divisive.
I would go further than that even. I would be willing to say without hesitation that we had this presumption that we had a system that was in bedrock, and it's not, and that it's not just volatile, but it's almost precarious, and it feels precarious in a way that we never imagined that it could be. And this is coming from somebody who works in this system, and I have been for a quarter of a century. And so when I look, well, 30 years actually, more than 30 years, and when you think of that, and you realize that. I know what it is to walk in the streets of the West Bank and know what they feel like. I've seen the same thing in war zones in Iraq, Afghanistan, when I was in Kosovo. You see that precariousness. And when you feel that precariousness there and you actually feel it inside your own country, it's really, really interesting and surprising.
I think what you're saying is Americans assume that when it gets to that level and it's before a judge is supposed to be an undisputed arbiter where politics doesn't enter in.
Right.
And yet that may not be the case.
That's exactly the problem. And the problem is the judge gamed against you? It's the system gamed against you. You thought that the sort of bedrock notions of who we were as a country were in place and were fixed. They're not. And what this did was shake that to the point that you started to realize that we weren't as unique as we thought we were.
That was criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor Jack Rice. He was speaking with me on Friday. In India, healthcare and frontline workers, along with people over the age of 60 with health complications, are lining up at vaccination centers to receive booster shots as infections linked to the Omicron variant surge. India is better prepared now than it was last year when the Delta variant overwhelmed hospitals. Millions are fully vaccinated, while others have antibodies from previous infections. But some experts say the belated distribution of booster shots may be costly. Moderna, Inc. said on Monday it expects record sales of about $18.5 billion in 2022 with contracts for its COVID-19 vaccines and about $3.5 billion in potential additional purchases, including booster candidates for COVID variants. Israel has granted residency rights to thousands of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and in the Gaza Strip after years of legal red tape. The residency allows people to get an official ID number and passport. Without official status, it is impossible to travel abroad and difficult to access many services. Human rights groups say Israel violated international law for withholding residency rights for so long, while the government portrays the decision as a goodwill gesture. Iran's prosecutor general has threatened to launch criminal proceedings against judiciary personnel who have protested against the denial of a planned pay raise. The Iranian official said such illegal action contradicts Sharia principles and are liable to legal action. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using two telescopes in Hawaii imaged for the very first time the final 130 days of a dying massive star before it blew up into a Type II supernova. According to a press release from the W.M. Keck Observatory, the red supergiant star had a mass 10 times that of our sun and located 120 million light-years away in a galaxy called NGC 5731. The supernova was named SN 2020 TLF. The star was first spotted by scientists with the Pan-STARR system at the Haleakala Observatory in the summer of 2020 and were joined by colleagues at the Keck Observatory. Astronomers at both facilities spent a few months observing the dying star until its life ended with a massive cosmic explosion in the fall of 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
So Hali Ahmadi was just 2 months old when he got separated from his parents during last August's U.S.-led evacuation of Kabul airport. Now he's been reunited with his Afghan family, which hopes he can be with his parents in the United States soon. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder has more.
Baby Sohail was separated from his family in the chaos of the Kabul evacuation. At last, he's been found and reunited with his grandfather. It's a historic day, says Mohammed Qasim Razawi. Sohail was just 2 months old when his parents handed him to a U.S. soldier across an airport wall on August the 19th. They feared for his safety in the crush. He went missing as thousands rushed to leave an Afghanistan falling under Taliban rule. After a Reuters exclusive published in November led to online posts of information, he was traced to the Kabul home of taxi driver Hamid Safi, who had named him Mohammed Abid and was raising him as his own.
I entered the airport and saw a baby lying on the ground in a very bad state. I looked around and showed the child to many people, but I couldn't find anyone related to him. I called my wife at home and I refused to go to America. I brought the child home. I brought him milk, and we have been taking care of the child since that time.
After more than 7 weeks of negotiations and pleas and a brief detention by Taliban police, Safi handed the child to a jubilant Razawi on Saturday. The boy's grandfather had traveled 2 days and two nights from the northeast to the capital, bearing gifts for Safi and his family, including a slaughtered sheep, pounds of walnuts, and clothing. It'll be hard to let him go. We love this child, Hamid's wife Farima says, but he must live with his parents. They are in the United States. Sohail's father, Mirza Ali Ahmadi, is a former U.S. Embassy security guard. He was nearly inside the airport when he passed the baby over, but at that moment, the Taliban pushed the crowd back. Officials told the desperate family once they got in that Sohail had probably been evacuated. They could be reunited later. They ended up at a military base in Texas with, until the story went public, no idea where their baby was. The family hopes to be together again soon. Their story highlights the plight of other families who were separated in the chaos of the evacuation.
That was Lucy Fielder from Reuters. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.